everybody. Put down your plates, finish your mimosas, because brunch is over.
We're on to, after that intro song, on to our very nonpartisan election coverage, I guess.
Well, I think everyone can agree that song is a lot of fun, even despite it having swung the Latino vote so heavily in Trump's favor that he won the election.
Is that what did it?
You know, it was Death by a Thousand Cuts. I think that was one of the cuts. It was, that and the Joe Rogan podcast.
I don't think you could blame just Miami Cubans this time, although they are, of course.
I know. I really thought the Puerto Ricans were going to come through and save us from Trump.
Listen.
We were fools right now.
I've got two Puerto Rican guys, and the one Puerto Rican guy voted. He was going to vote Jill Stein, but at the last minute, he got into the booth and he pulled the lever for Kamala Harris. The other guy is like 100% Trump, just like Trump, Puerto Rico, let's fucking go. He was so hyped yesterday. I don't know what this means politically. I don't know what it means ideologically. But yesterday at 3 o'clock, like we usually knock off at 3:30, he's like, we go home at 3 o'clock today because Trump's president. Let's go, Trump. Trump is for the men. And the foreman's like, bro, it doesn't work that way. In his mind, though, Trump is president, so you get to steal a half hour from the boss.
But he said he was for the men. That's why.
The working men. Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. That's what it means, for the men. You know, if a foreman is for the men, it means like he takes care of you. He lets you go a little early. In this case, ideologically, Trump is for the men, but he's also for the men too, as we saw in this election.
And the men are for him. So we are here. We've got the Antifada election desk roundtable for everyone. We have Jana Kirti from Hard Crackers Journal, longtime friend of the show, calling in from Buenos Aires. Maybe a vision, a not too distant vision into our future. And we have Reed Kane at Labor Republican on Twitter. Hello, Reed.
Hello.
And then finally, we have C. Derek Varn.
Hello.
He's going to be diving into this wreckage with us. Jana, it's fascinating to me that you're coming to us from Argentina. You've seen what's happened back in the home country in the United States. Obviously, Trump won. Do you think that there's a chance that we're going to end up in Javier Milei's Argentina type situation? What are things like over there?
Yeah, I mean, I think definitely a lot of parallels and similarities between Milei and Trump, in kind of their character, the way they ran the election, the sort of like the embrace of this like very machista, manly, like beating your chest, but also punching down at like Marxist, the quote unquote liberal woke left. I think Milei during his campaign actually appeared on stage with a chainsaw saying that he was going to cut the state. So there's a lot of similarities. And just now actually a friend, send me a meme of Milei congratulating Trump on this victory, you know, and saying, make America great again. And there's in Spanish, like, you know, we're approaching towards freedom. So I think there's a lot of similarities. And actually, I was talking to somebody here in Buenos Aires the other day, an older gentleman who's in his 50s. And he said something to me really interesting. He said, you know, despite it all, despite the fact that Trump and Milei may look similar, Trump is pretty normal for you guys. I wouldn't expect Trump to win in America. You know, he's like, we're still shocked that Milei won in Argentina. And I think that speaks to a lot of the differences in the both countries. And without getting too much into it, I mean, Argentina, despite the failures of Peronism and, you know, a very like conservative social democracy, still had a bit of a social democracy, right? And, you know, people believe in collectivity, society, right? All of which Milei has threatened to take away. Something that's a little bit different from the United States, right? And I think the fear is that, you know, in Argentina, just like in the US, both will do a lot of damage to the state. But I think people here have a little small taste of social democracy, right? Especially universities, healthcare. And they see Milei really as a threat. But I think it's really interesting that, again, the U.S. and the world over, we're seeing the rise of these authoritarian figureheads.
And we'll get more into this, but part of Trump's like wingnut protectionist economic plans are pretty similar to what Milei is doing, which is interesting because Milei is sort of carrying out the austerity that's been demanded on Argentina by finance for decades. So he's kind of just, in a way, just like a continuation of the neoliberal wing of the Argentinian mm-hmm. political class. But yeah, Trump's plans of doing this are, I think, a lot more radical than like the devolution revolution type thinking of Gingrich and stuff like that. But we'll see how much he's able to do. But interestingly, Musk has been talking about this on Twitter and being like, yeah, the economy is going to get really, really bad for a while, but then it'll be good after that, which is exactly what's happening in Argentina right now, where Milei's reforms have already tanked the economy even worse than it was before, under the pretenses that the free market will come roaring back in and solve everything.
It's interesting. I don't know if we want to go in this direction very like at the very beginning, because we have a bunch of different questions for our panelists, so we can go back and forth and have the conversation. But one of the questions that Andy and I came up with is what are the international reverberations of Trump's win? And doesn't it feel like now that there is sort of like in world politics, there's playing out a sort of like vital center of like Harris and Starmer and Schultz in Germany and so on and so forth, but then also like a new sort of national populist uprising in some places like Argentina. It takes more libertarian in places like Hungary. It takes on a more sort of like economic nationalist anti-EU thing. What do we think about the international reverberations? I would start with Derek, and then maybe we'll go to Reed and Jana. What do you think?
International reverberations. One, the right populist backlash in America is late. Two, it actually mirrors the same backlash that put Starmer in power almost to the numbers. By that I mean that, yeah, sure, Trump won, and he won legitimately and in a landslide, but how he won is because the Democrats lost 10 to 15 million votes between 2020 and 2024. Trump didn't gain that much, if any. We are looking at between gaining less than a million, or maybe he even lost up to 4 million. We won't know until all the rest of the West Coast states are counted. His base clearly cared, and the Democrats' base clearly didn't trust them. And the Democratic strategy was very clearly to double down on specifically college-educated women as their demographic thing. And they ignored, I mean, the polls were bad. There were a couple of good polls that had good numbers on Trump, but most of the polls were bad. However, the Democrats also selectively ignored polls that hurt their prior messaging. So the whole like threat to democracy thing, which no one believes, polls say no one believes. Everybody's worried about American democracy, but no one thinks Trump is really going to be the end of it. They ignored that and kept running with that message, as they have been trying to all the way back to 2020. And to me, like, do people even remember, like, in 2021 when they were trying to get us to buy that we were at the brink of a fucking civil war with what constituency base, like political constituency base for that? And then when you push them, they're like, oh, well, we mean like right-wing stochastic terrorism. I'm like, one, that's not a civil war, and two, we already have some of that, and three, that didn't even get that much worse. That didn't even get worse. So it's, I am very confused as to what we're supposed to take from this. And I'm a little bit more irritated today. I was very stoic about it on when I listened to Trump's speech. I actually felt nothing. I do realize that there's a lot of people who are going to be negatively affected by this. Although how positively they would have been affected by a Harris win is yet to have been seen, particularly since in the very last 2 weeks in the Dick Cheney, Liz Cheney / Harris unity tour. There was also movements for them to take more rightward stands on trans issues, more rightward stands on the police, and more rightward stands on Gaza. And CNN this morning was basically saying, well, maybe Trump won because Jews didn't feel like that Harris supported Israel enough.
Yeah, and they're trying to blame
Wow.
They're trying to blame it on woke, right enough, but there's just no evidence for this. Like, this is not the campaign that she ran, so it's just, I think it's just, like, political consultants trying to save their own asses for their role in it. Two things I want to say on the international question, then I'll toss it off to Reed. So, two immediate international reverberations. The German government is collapsing. There's going to be snap elections there, I believe, in which the AfD has a chance to take power in some way. And then in Israel, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister who is part of this war unity government, was fired on election day. And so there's been the return of these anti-Netanyahu protests, mostly in Tel Aviv. So those are two immediate things, and I'm sure there'll be a lot more.
One more thing I can say is the German government has passed much more draconian laws on dealing with criticisms of Israel, including and up to revoking your citizenship for criticizing Israel, which may be a way to try to limit the ADF, but it looks particularly dire.
You got all a response around on this one, Reed? Or?
I mean, I could say a little bit. I don't really have any, developed thoughts about specific international implications. But, you know, there's obviously, I mean, people have been remarking, especially since the election happened, on, you know, Trump's election being part of this kind of ongoing crisis of incumbency in governments around the world. Which has, you know, it was kind of something similar happening the first time he was elected as well. And I think they're being assimilated to each other as well. That's maybe a repetition of what was happening, about 10 years ago, or a continuation of it, or what have you. I think, you know, I mean, look, it's easy to assimilate these things together into broad categories, and not that that's not useful. But I think we're really trying to grope at what's going on right now in terms that already make sense to us, terms that are familiar to us from, you know, the past, from the recent past and, you know, the broader past, which is, you know, you have to do that, obviously, but there is an automatic kind of peril you get yourself into in doing that, which is you are unable to recognize when something new is happening unless you're able to assimilate it to the appearance of what came before. And, you know, it may look similar. That doesn't mean it is actually functioning in a similar way or has the same, kind of internal logic or direction and so on. So, you know, I mean, I think of this stuff more in terms of ideology. You know, politics is really, it's an ideological spectacle. I don't think that, you know, we could debate who's going to do what and how, what effects is that going to have. But, you know, I mean, I don't, have a lot of opinions about that sort of thing because, you know, what is my opinion worth? My sense of it is there's an ideological shift that's reflecting an underlying shift. Chris Catrone has kind of brought up this idea of Trumpism as post-neoliberalism. So not the end of neoliberalism, a continuation, but also a change in the configuration of, sort of how capital is produced and circulates and accumulates and so on. Some people have talked about the crisis of the American empire for quite a while now, going back, you know, to 2008 at least, probably before that. I mean, probably 2001, people were saying the same thing. I was a little young then to know, to remember that, but
they were.
Yeah. So, you know, there's been that conversation going on are the BRICS countries rising to at least offset the role of the US, if not outright replace it or perhaps to replace it? And maybe that's the case. You know, I've heard a lot of things about China's relationship to the other BRICS countries being pretty unstable and China being like the anchor of that whole thing. It's not necessarily, you know, I don't know if it has that sort of internal coherence that it would need. But I also think it's like pretty, it's easy to have this sort of myopia and just write off the US as like a declining empire. It's like an easy analogy to reach for. People have been saying that the West in general and the US in particular over the last century have been a declining empire for, as long as it's kind of been in the center, yeah, you know,
Oswald Spengler, you know.
Yeah, yeah, it goes back a long ways, you know. But if you look at it in terms of what the United States is, like the concentration of, you know, all the different factors of global capital that are kind of consolidated in or that all intersect on the United States. It's not like what Britain was in the 19th century. It's not a small island off the coast of a continent that it basically controls, but, you know, in a complicated way. The U.S. is a continent, you know, essentially, and it has all of the power of that population, of that land. You know, it has an internal market that's comparable to the Asian market, the European market, the South American market, you know, and it kind of controls the South American market to some extent as well, you know, since going back to the Monroe Doctrine. So anyway, I know I'm getting a little long-winded, but my basic point is there's a shift going on. I don't know if it's what we necessarily think it is. I think it maybe is showing us that things are changing in a way that maybe we need to be open to thinking differently about them. Maybe that's just a way to start. So
a good way to start. It's a good way to open things up. Shauna, go ahead.
I think this is a really interesting, important topic. I follow this blog called Naked Capitalism, and they had a really good post about like the fears of Trump imposing like tariffs. I don't know if you guys remember, but on the campaign trail, he's like, tariffs is the most beautiful word and a beautiful word in the American dictionary, you know?
William Howard Taft.
He's like vowed to put this like universal 10% tariff. And I mean, I think in that way, like his policies are, so while there is kind of a global authoritarian far right that's, you know, we could see being elected, they are very different from each other, right? Mm-hmm. The Milei in Argentina is very committed to free market. You know, he's like a libertarian economist. Trump is a protectionist, right? So it will be interesting to see what these tariffs mean. I'm not even sure they're going to be instituted. He wanted to replace the federal tax system. People are just like, that's not going to happen. And one thing they will have is that, you know, he's trying to obviously create more revenue for the United States, protect, you know, protect U.S. corporations. But like what will happen with the tariffs is that pricing will be passed on to consumers. They're going to have higher products. They're going to have to pay higher prices. And the Democrats were kind of right when they said, I think it would cost like what American families, like $4,000 extra. So there's going to be like the unintended effects of its like economic policies. But I think one thing is for certain that Trump coming into power this time again also is fueling a lot of uncertainties in the global market, right?
Yeah. The S&P 500 is up today, though. So yeah. Some people are certain about something.
And some people made money off that, off the Bitcoins. I'm like, damn it. Don't have too much to invest. But
My Trump voting coworker, big Bitcoin fan. He's made a windfall the last couple of days. I guess to close out this topic, what I would say is, I think I'm sympathetic with what everybody says, and I think keeping an open mind is really, really important. It's clear that bourgeois politics for like the last, I don't know, decade and a half or so have been at some sort of impasse, right? And I think that impasse, no matter how fine a point we want to put it on, is probably somehow attached to like capitalist growth rates and employment and profitability. Trump appears to certain factions of the capitalist class locally and globally, and certain fractions of the working class in the United States as like a political force that can push past this impasse. For better or for worse, that's what they believe. And so we should take it seriously. We should take this election seriously. We should take what Trump says seriously, and take seriously the idea that all of us, having been born somewhere between, I don't know, 30 and 50 years ago or so, have grown up under certain political preconceptions and certain economic conditions. And we're at a moment in time right now where things truly are in flux. So whether that's like from neoliberalism into post-neoliberalism, or it's a continuation and a deepening of neoliberalism with like Milei and Trump and others kind of bringing more of a libertarian bent to that thing, remains to be seen. But, you know, I think we're all clear that internationally and in the United States, this is a real signal moment. I guess, you know, another question to ask, and this is, I think, related to the conversation that we just had, is according to polls, you know, we don't do our own polls here. It'd be pretty cool if we had Antifada polls to start calling people up and asking them about shit, about the class struggle or whatever. But according to like Pew polls and surveys, right, most U.S. voters this time around considered that the United States as a nation was on the wrong track. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that. What do we think that means, that U.S. voters thought that this country is on the wrong track? Was it inflation? Was it the wars? Was it general insecurity?
I think it's a trolley problem meme that was going around.
Trolley problem meme. Yeah. Okay.
They're talking about the trolley problem.
Who was on the tracks in that?
So that's the thing, is they were just referring to whatever version of the meme they saw. And so it could be anything.
Anything. So let's dive into this. Let's dive into that wreckage. Varn, what do you think about this? What is this this country's on the wrong track thing, and what do you think that's all about in this election?
Well, there's a couple of things. And I do not know that any of these things directly translate into any particular political ideology, but they would translate into a want for change. One, we've been told that the American economy is doing well. At the same time, the stats for blue collar workers, and I use blue collar workers here advisedly, meaning non-college educated workers, in the service sector and in logistics and manufacturing, have seen, their relative purchasing parity decline. Service workers saw it go up. We actually separate those out, but still, working class men, have seen declines in marriage, declines in cohabitation, declines in work. So, I mean, you know, literally, they 10% of blue collar men don't have jobs. They are on disability, or they're stay at home dads, or whatever. But the stay at home dad part can't be a huge part of that, because we also seen a decline in blue collar men having children or getting married or even being in marked relationships, according to survey after survey after survey. So there's a demographic that we haven't been speaking about on the left. That's, I don't know, 49% to 51% of the population. Even factoring out college educated people, you're down to like 30. Who are very dissatisfied. We've also seen the hollowing out of a large part of the American heartland in terms of jobs, in organic capital composition being devoted to tech and large in areas with large populations. This is manifested in kind of two ways, one in a kind of right-wing backlash, and the other in, I actually think it's also why you see stuff like BLM where you did. They always start in like the former industrial Midwest, and they die in liberal strongholds on the coast, but it starts there. I don't want to be totally economistic. I don't think you can explain everything in terms of economic terms, but I don't know, maybe people feel like the country's going in the wrong direction because they don't see a way out, and yet they're being told, as far as the GDP stats, that things are going good. But when we actually look at our GDP stats and look at them in a kind of micro level, what did we see generating a lot of this GDP? Stuff like AI investment that is not yet proven profitable. It may be profitable. We don't know. I'm not, you know, I can't say one way or the other if they're going to work out all the energy cost bugs, etc. I'm not a technician, but I'm not particularly hopeful on that. At the same time, I'm going to pick up something that Reed brought up and actually say, you know, we hear a lot about the American empire declining, and people will start talking about things like China, et cetera. Well, the only of the major powers that's had really big economic growth has been Russia, and that's because it's finally been putting its own domestic consumption economy into play, which it didn't do after the fall of the Soviet Union. And
during the Soviet Union too.
Yeah. And India, which is finally seemingly going through something like an industrialization boom. So it's got like 8% GDP. Still not China in the 90s or aughts, but it's good. China seems to have a business cycle, hasn't gone negative yet, but it is not making its own GDP goals. So it is also clear from people that they don't really see another model out there. Like there's no, you know, and that's also, we have to also admit that this is only even for like real connected people who are watching everything around the world, which is not very many people, but
at least five of us.
But there's not like no one is giving anyone an offer. I remember like in 2016, even to 2019, 2020, you even heard liberals talk about China as like an economic and political and social miracle. That's all gone away. Mm. So when you look at that, it seems like America is on the wrong path, but there's also no clear other model to, I mean, like you want to be Europe right now, Germany's productive sector just kind of tanked because it was basically floating on cheap Russian gas. And,
not to mention German car makers are getting their asses kicked by
Chinese. Right. And not having really strong competition out of Asia, which they now have. So a lot of people feel that. And a lot of people feel like they've been gaslit by a lot of liberal elites who've been telling them things have been fine for 4 years.
What do you think, Reed?
I agree with a lot of what Derek was saying. I agree. You know, I agree that you shouldn't try to boil everything down to economics. Also, on the other hand, you know, like I wouldn't think about it that way. You don't have to kind of reduce things to economics to understand how everything has a kind of fundamentally economic basis. You know, in a kind of old fashioned Marxist way. I think those two things get conflated. Not that Derek was conflating them, but I do think that tends to happen where people like think, oh, it's everything's just determined by something else. It's like, well, no, everything is bound up in economic relations, you know, because if it exists, then it has to, you know, somebody made it, you know, not somebody, but millions of people were involved in making it one way or another. Keeping that in mind, there's a clear sense amongst the population, and probably not just in the United States, but specifically in the United States, that we've sort of reached the limits of the way we've been doing things for the last several decades. You know, it hasn't been, it doesn't seem sustainable. And that's that manifests in all sorts of ways. You know, it doesn't just manifest in a directly, you know, economic sense, although it is very much manifest in a directly economic sense. You know, all of the different symptoms, you know, that we are associating with this sort of current political kind of chaos, divisive sort of breakdown of civil relationships and so on. You know, I think that's really symptomatic of a broader problem that's also, you know, fundamentally economic at the end of the day. And so, you know, what is the problem? I think it's pretty simple. Like, I mean, if you want to be like a Marxist about it, you know,
I think we want to be speaking about it, please, by all means.
You know, the fundamental dynamic is very basic and very simple. You know, it's essentially, a process of accumulation that the accumulation is an accumulation that kind of ultimately starts expanding exponentially in a way that outruns the ability of society to use that accumulating capital to invest that capital profitably. It becomes harder and harder to do that the higher and higher that rate of accumulation goes, because the working class can't consume that whole product. It cannot. If it does, if the working class's consumption increases, it puts pressure on capital in the form of demand that makes it necessary for capital to accumulate even faster, you know? So there's no way you can stop that from happening as long as there's wage labor. There's no way. So all we can do is try to deal with the symptoms that arise and try to manage the crisis that inevitably breaks out at the end of the day when you reach the breaking point and suddenly you can't sell anything because there's too much to sell. So nobody wants to sell anything because everything's too cheap. They won't make enough money. You know, so not that it gets, I mean, obviously it's more complicated than that, but it's more complicated than that because of the layers and layers and layers of mediation we put on top of that to try to control it. And a lot of those layers are political, or at least they have a relationship to the political superstructure, in the form of bureaucracy, in the form of unproductive consumption. You know, how do you deal with this problem? Well, if the working class can't consume that, and if you give it to the capitalists, they're going to invest it, which makes the problem worse. You have to have a layer of society that consumes as much of that surplus unproductively as possible. And, you know, so there's all sorts of rationales for how and why you do that. You know, there's, you know, philanthropic sort of, you know, welfare state oriented things. There's war, there's et cetera. Although war can be tricky because then you start accumulating more wealth, you know. there's all sorts of different things. But, you know, fundamentally, we have in the United States, we certainly have two parties that are, you know, they're both capitalist parties. They both represent the capitalist class. They're both involved in the capitalist state. But ideologically speaking, they have different tilts that reflect kind of different basic tendencies in society. And, you know, they're pretty simple, you know, and they've really been the same since the 19th century, despite some of the changes that have happened in the 20th century. Those are kind of ideological, but the fundamental dynamic is the Republican Party represents the capitalist class in its capacity as capitalists, you know, trying to accumulate wealth, to be capitalist, to have accumulating capital.
That's certainly what Trump represents, and he represents that to a lot of people.
And the neoliberal, you know, Ronald Reagan did too, but in a different way, because conditions were different at the time. So what that meant was different, you know. Whereas the Democrats are the party of the petty bourgeois democracy, you know, which is what they've always been. And the petty bourgeoisie is a complicated thing because it's not one thing. It's a mass of different things all lumped together in a kind of incoherent way. It has a basic general property of being bound between the two classes and kind of torn asunder between them. So it's always either falling into poverty or it's trying to rise up as high as possible and become capitalists themselves, if maybe, or at least, you know, have a happy working life, not as somebody else's wage slave. So, you know, that's what the Democrats are, but the Democrats don't represent like the petty bourgeois, self-employed or small capitalist, really. Because that's not the major section of the middle class now. It's you know, what they call the PMC. You know, I don't like that term, but the PMC, professionals, particularly. But that's not really a class, and that's not really what it is. You know, what it really is the bureaucracy, which is also not a class, but it is what the land owning class used to be.
Are you talking about
a sociological fact?
You're talking about civil servants or like the kind of privatized aspects of civil service, like NGOs and
It's the whole thing. I think it's, you know, mainly
probably and
mainly like the administrative bureaucracy of the state, but then the whole nonprofit sector is an outgrowth of that basic principle. Literally, it's called nonprofit because that's what it is. It's non-profitable, you know, consumption of wealth, you know, in a non-capital reproductive or non-labor power reproductive way, you know, and then of course it also penetrates into the capitalist enterprises themselves because the capitalists have to do what the state demands. And so they have to have people in their organizations that meet those demands that are kind of doing the necessary unproductive consumption of capital that the state demands of capitalists.
So this is going to sound like I'm just making a little zinger here, but it's like when Elon Musk buys up Twitter and turns it into X, he gets rid of all those like censorship people and all of like the people interfacing between the FBI and Twitter or whatever. And he bureaucratizes it. He makes it free, which is kind of in a larger, broader sense, what the ideology behind Trumpism is, right? It's about getting rid of the like swaths of the unproductive sector, whether that's in government or whether it's in DEI offices or whether it's in other types of like petty bureaucrats, get rid of those so that you can get back to like a more laissez-faire, dynamic, productive capitalist economy.
Well, that's And I'll wrap up because I know I've been going on, but just to come back on that, you know, yes, except the laissez-faire thing kind of confuses things. And so does the neoliberalism thing and the Malay comparison, because, you know, I mean, the thing is, Trump is very much not like Malay and very much not like these sort of libertarian-esque politicians in very fundamental ways. You know, the tariff policy being the most obvious one, but also the anti-immigration policy, or the, you know, the restriction on immigration is a complete, I don't know how Malay handles immigration. I don't know a lot about Argentina, you know, beyond superficial things, but, you know, I mean, that's a complete anti-free market thing to restrict immigration, right? Mm-hmm. And so on. So, you know, so the point I was trying to make, you know, in drawing that sort of little diagram there, is that, you know, we've had a big push back towards the existing kind of post-Fordist neoliberal form of this bureaucracy that's existed for a while. That's what the whole Obama administration was, and so was the Bush administration completely. It was, you know, obviously the war side of things. So I think what Trump kind of represents in that regard is, you know, obviously the Republicans have this sort of small business, entrepreneurial, self-employed layer of the working class, like the non-proletarian, you know, petty bourgeois part of the working class, attached to them because they're kind of, they see themselves as allied to the capitalists in this, you know, more or less pro-business politics, you know, small business, big business, you know.
And interestingly, those people are not discontented with the world, right? Like they live the politics of joy. They are the people that under Clinton, remember, she said, like, America's is already great. And then you have, of course, great unwashed masses who feel otherwise. I think Zhanna and then Andy, or Andy and then Zhanna.
Yeah, actually, Zhanna, what you just said, I was going to say something similar along those lines. I think, like, just our experiences with inflation is, like, really speaks to, you know, what you just talked about. I think there's just so much. So even as inflation is going down, right, people are still experiencing grocery prices up, right? Even though my mom, not a Trump supporter, hey, Ma, she, you know, she's always complaining. Like every time I talk to her on the phone, she's like, hey, they're saying the economy is getting better, but I go to the grocery store and like prices are still quite high. They're getting high, like, you know, groceries are really expensive. So I think a
rent
lot of
too Americans, is a big yeah, inflation
well,
point.
Well, first I want to say, right, like the causes of inflation, how the Democrats explained it versus how Trump explained it was very different, right? Mm-hmm. I think the Democrats were like, oh, what are you talking about? Like unemployment is it's at an all-time low. Inflation is going down. Like things are great. They're going to be fine. We're going to, you know, Harris had this like tax break she's going to give homeowners, right? Because our current inflation, much of it is due to the inability of young people to buy homes, yeah. Right? But I think sort of like how everyday people experience inflation, right? And despite the fact that it is going down, prices are still going up, right? So people experience that, right? They go to grocery stores, they're afraid of what that means in their future. And I just want to say that we're still living in this like post-COVID economy. Yeah. Right. We still had very high inflation during COVID, due to just basically the inability to move, you know, goods and services around. Right. So it's like, I don't know, I still feel like we're reeling in this economy, but somehow like it got all put on Biden and whatever. Like, I'm not a Democrat. I hate the Democrats. But it's like it all got put on Biden and they just couldn't explain it. Like they couldn't get out of it. Right. They couldn't explain to average voters like why and how they feel that way. And I think something that as leftists we should be doing, and this is why I really appreciate this show, is like taking this like bottom line materialist analysis and explaining it in a way that makes sense to people and that people could understand, right? Without, you know, I mean, we should all read Marx, but without all of us having to read that, right? It's like, how can we explain it in a way that makes sense to people? But I think a lot of folks look at the prices and they don't care that the quote unquote real economy is doing well. They just see what happens to them when they go to the store, you know?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, let me jump.
Varn, you want to say something and then we'll move on.
Maybe, yeah, we've been going on for this question for a while and I'm maybe like yeah, a sure. transition and I think there'll be opportunity to come back to it in the next go round.
Yes.
Yeah. So we're just talking about sort of the economic factors of this, and without really connecting it to what we saw in the election and exit polls and that sort of thing. And it is the continuation of lower income voters to Trump. And the biggest surges that Trump saw in decisive swing states were in counties where exit polls showed people had the worst opinion of the economy and claimed to be struggling the most. So what were the proposals for inflation that the candidates proposed? Kamala said she's just going to make it illegal. which sounds like
inflation is illegal.
Sounds like a cool answer, right? But I think even all of the kind of cool things that she approached promising are just sort of nullified by the fact that she's already in power and her administration did this. So no one really believes that. Trump's answer was totally nonsensical. He says that we're going to drill, baby, drill. And then so it's basically just trickle down economics. Like you were saying, Reed, the Republicans are the party of capital. They see Trump as capital and they're like, all right, let's give capital a try. Maybe it'll make me rich. Capitalists are rich. Maybe I'll get rich. And, you know, desperate, you know, you only have two dumb choices and you're struggling and you're going to make that second choice. So then that's what we saw in exit polls. But I also wanted to transition to talk about some of the cultural shifts and maybe we can theorize about what the economics are behind that, if anything. So the two subjects I want to throw out there is first racial depolarization. Certainly amongst Latinos, Trump won Latinos in some places. You didn't see as much of a shift with Black people, but I think he did better than 2020. And then another thing I want to throw out there, see what you think it could be is a real thing or not, is the Joe Rogan effect. The fact that Trump spent so much of his campaign on podcasts, you know, just like this one, maybe a little bigger than this one.
And you should have got him on.
Oh, you didn't have him
on? No.
No, we didn't get the Trump bump, man. Somehow Rogan won out over us.
Yeah, we tried.
We should have got Harris on. That would have been more on brand.
He seems very fun to talk to. And I think Harris lost a lot of the youth vote. Because in these counties where her margins were lower, like a lot of them were college counties, and they showed big shifts towards Trump. So that same group is saying, like, why wouldn't Harris go on Joe Rogan? What, is she afraid? She can't have a normal conversation with this normal man? And there's a lot of reasons why she wouldn't, but it hurt that she didn't. And
so you have like a dual question then. There's like a racial depolarization, and there's also like a whole gendered dimension to this question as well.
And that like didn't show Trump as big shifts as we expected either. Like there was a theory that there'd be these secret societies of bourgeois women out there pledging to vote Kamala in secret, and it just didn't happen. All of those things, let's go around, see what people think.
Let's start with Jana this time, and then we'll work our way back. What do you have to say on these topics?
I have a lot to say, but I will try to distill it in a few thoughts. First, I want to say that I feel like the elections turned me into a political pundit where I'm just like, this is what happened. Like, the reason was the economy. The reason was immigration. The reason was Gaza. And the reality is that the polls kind of take this, like, make it about these single issues. They kind of give numbers to what are very complex social issues and complex discontent, right? So I just want to be careful about, like, us coming together and saying it was, like, one over the other. I think there was actually a confluence of forces that came together for a Trump victory. And I think they're not sometimes so easily disentangled, right? So the question of inflation and the economy is very much tied to immigration, right? Yeah. And the fact that Trump was saying, you know, would say that, hey, like, we need to control the surge of immigration because it is not, that's not only contributing to crime, that's going to contribute to higher inflation, right? So there's ways in which kind of these issues gel together that I think it's up to us to kind of bring that together, right? Because I think it's easy to just focus on single issues with the polls, right? And numbers don't capture experiences. But, you know, I mean, I think Bernie said it correctly, for better or worse, right? Where he said the Democratic Party has turned its back and has abandoned working class voters, right? So the first thing I would say is that the Democrats, this is not their first run, right? They, you know, this would have essentially put them in power for what? Like, I mean, they've been in power for over a decade, right? People are tired of all the promises, of all the ways that they were going to, you know, change, right? So I think there's a complete discontent with the Democratic Party, and we could delve into that. But I think the way to explain the material basis for the election is that, I mean, historically, right, especially in the United States, elites have lied to working class whites, right? And now Latinos, who many of which are vying to be white, right? So it's like, in this moment of economic uncertainty, white working class folks are not going to want to be a solidarity with Black and Latino immigrants, right? They're going to look and preserve their own self-interest. I mean, you look at any moment in history, this has essentially what has happened. So I feel like, you know, we are back to some degree to the 2016 moment, right? Where we're like, you know, again, hand-wringing about the white working class going for Trump, white women, right, with abortion and all of this that's, you know, about to, that, you know, Roe v. Wade being rolled back, still went for Trump. But, you know, I do think, like, at least in the United States, you know, whiteness has a real material base, right? Like, white working class folks have, you know, essentially looked out for their own interests. They haven't essentially identified with other marginalized groups. So I kind of expected them to kind of go for Trump. And I would say the anti-immigrant rhetoric was kind of quite strong this election cycle. And I think the fact that, and I think this is why so many people are pissed, is because with immigration, with abortion, you know, a lot of voters for Trump were like, I don't care about that. I care about the economy, not realizing how interconnected they are, even though there are moments that they are a little bit quite separate. I have other stuff to say, but I'll pass it on. And
here's a question for you, though, based on your response. Are you saying then that in a sense, like Latino voters who voted for Trump as opposed to Harris, they chose like class interests over ethnic or national interests, or that they chose individual interests over like some purported collective interest of all Latino people?
I think voting, like, I think first we should, like, I don't know, I'm kind of critical of voting. Like, look, voting is like a great temperature check. And unfortunately, we have Trump for the next 4 years. It's going to be a disaster. But in many ways, not everybody votes. Voting is like such a specific, you know, such a specific act that we put like so much emphasis on. And we're trying to read all of these like dynamics to. People vote for very single issues in America. That has always historically been the case.
Or on vibes.
Yeah, on vibes, right? But I think for Latino men, I mean, you know, and I'm sure a lot is going to be talked about. I think for sure class interest. But I think, first of all, there are many Latinos who agree with Trump on immigration, who want to stop, quote unquote, illegal immigration. Right. There's a lot of contradictions even within Latino communities about who comes here legally versus illegally. So that's big. I think the machismo of Trump appeals to a lot of Latino men. You know, I mean, I don't know if you guys saw Trump in the barbershops in the Bronx. I was like, oh, no, it's a wrap. You know, give him some Brugal and it's like, it's over. They're going to be best friends. You know? So I think like the machismo, I think like Latinos vying for whiteness. I mean, all of those things, I think, play a role in why Latinos went for Trump.
And on the non-voting issue really quick, it should also be noted that Harris was running to the right of Trump on immigration. She was saying that she wanted to pass this bill that went farther than what Trump wanted. And then she was even saying that she was complete building the wall, which Trump doesn't even run on anymore. And so she's kind of saying like, oh, Trump doesn't want to build the wall, but I will. So even if you're a Latino who was still upset about kids in cages, which was what Biden ran on, that just wasn't on the ballot.
Reed.
And I do want to say that I thought it was interesting. The reaction of, you know, Puerto Ricans throughout the United States when the comments was made by that comedian, you know, and I think Fat Joe like took the stage and was like, this is why you got to vote for Harris. And this was this moment where I was like, man, Puerto Ricans are going to come through. But then I think, I think also what happened is that people get mad but are they going to get mad enough to go vote, right? Or are they going to get mad and like stay home? And it looks like a lot of people stayed home, right? I mean, we're still counting votes and the polls are still a little bit early. But I mean, Kamala, like what, 10 to 13 million people stayed home?
Yeah, I think it was 15 to 20 million less than last election. So that's it's a decisive drop.
Fat Reed, Joe also performed before the Yankees World Series disaster, too. Go ahead.
Maybe it was hatred of the
Yankees.
They're
calling him for all the disasters.
Everyone hates the Yankees, so that might have been part of it, too. Reed, what do you have on this question of racial depolarization and the man question, the masculinity question, the machismo?
The man question, yeah. Well, you know, so I actually didn't quite get to the end of my last point. I know I was going on a bit, but good. It's not a bad thing because it feeds directly into what I have to say on this, which is, I think a lot of the way the Republican Party oriented itself since the Reagan Revolution has been, I mean, we all know what it's basically been, right? It's been that sort of combination of the Christian element of like the kind of libertarian-ish kind of business oriented element and the sort of
neocon, right?
Yeah, well, I would say that's like obviously been the kind of policy and sort of maybe to some extent the kind of ideology side, you know, in the sense of kind of the mass ideology. You know, so there's that element. I would say it's more in terms of the popular side of the neocon thing. It's more like the kind of patriotism thing, you know, it's a kind of like a cultural identity and sort of which is only just a way people think about themselves and their relationships to each other the way I think about this stuff anyway. And the same goes for like kind of, you know, racial communities or, you know, any other kinds of like communal kind of identities, but it's more than identities, right? It's, you know, relationships, actual relationships between people that, and sometimes organizations and nonprofits and the Democratic Party, sometimes this stuff is like overrun with that sort of stuff. And sometimes it's more organic. You know, the Republicans, I think, have a little bit of an organic element in a sense, but it's organic in the kind of the capitalist sense that it's like kind of like the rot that grows on the outside of like a dumpster or something. I don't mean that to be like an insult to any. I didn't mean that as like a dig. I've been reading.
I'm sure all of our Republican listeners will be upset.
No, I really didn't. I realized that sounded like some sort of Democrat attack on Republicans, which is not at all how I actually meant it. I was thinking about this book I've been reading about, basically about the hollowing out of the mainstream parties. And so they were talking about how like the Republican Party was infiltrated by these, you know, what they call special interest groups that are not part of the party, but they are literally like a lobbying group inside the party, lobbying the party to lobby, you know what I mean? So it's like that sort of stuff, you know, that these sort of organizations that aren't organic in the sense of like they come out of the people, but they aren't civil society organizations, right? They're like, they are actually organic coagulations of these capitalist interests amongst themselves. So, you know, but what Trump represents in terms of a shift from that is his orientation towards not the working class as aspiring capitalists, as petty bourgeois, hardworking people that are hustling to become capitalists, you know?
This is what Harris says, yeah.
Right. That's, if anything, that's what Harris has been saying. Whereas Trump is very explicitly making an appeal, not in the terms that the left would think about this, but making an appeal to proletarian workers. You know, that's what the immigration thing is really about, in my opinion. I think the racial stuff, I'm not going to say there isn't any of that. Of course there is, but I don't think it's as central as it's made out to be. And I also think it's a symptom of the economic problems. It's not, you know, that kind of metastasizes into something somewhat independent, but at the end of the day, it's sitting on top of those things and is expressing something going on beneath their feet, so to speak. And so, you know, there has obviously been since the Reagan era, you know, since the neoliberal, you know, since the offshoring revolution that kind of cleared out the American industrial workforce in the 70s and 80s and so on. We all know why Trump won in 2016. It's because Hillary Clinton was the wife of the guy that did NAFTA.
Yep.
That's why he won.
On the job.
You know, so it, that so the trade agreements, the trade renegotiations, the tariffs, which the union guys love, by the way, you know, the union guys love the tariffs because they protecting American industry and it's bringing back American industry. That's the idea anyway. Same thing with the energy, you know, so in terms of the inflation thing that came up before, you know, the whole thing with Trump is flood the market with cheap energy, because what is inflation? You know, inflation, everyone thinks inflation is because there's too much money, which, well, okay, that's the neoliberal, or that's, sorry, the neoclassical theory. But the Marx's way of thinking about this is that inflation fundamentally is because prices are rising too high. It's not that prices are rising because there's too much money. And of course, you can overissue token currency and inflate the money supply that way, which they do so that they can hide a continuous downward pressure on wages that only takes the form of falling real wages instead of nominal changes in the wage. You know, so this has been happening for 40, 50 years, and immigration has been part of that the whole time, because, you know, there was this liberalization of immigration in the 80s, going back to Reagan again. So, you know, they want their labor market protected with immigration reform. They want the capital market protected with tariffs and trade renegotiations. And, you know, they want the state to be cut down in terms of the regulations and, you know, extraneous spending in the executive branch that costs money, that makes it cost more money to produce things than it otherwise would, which makes it more expensive for capitalists to employ workers. So that's the whole thing.
Right? I'll say a couple of things before we shoot it over to Varn. Number one is, I don't think that workers necessarily see it as like capital versus labor. They Trump as the I'm not saying you said this, but they see Trump and the Republicans as its capitalist party as being the party of employers.
Right.
And I know I'm in the very business union building trades that, like, you want to make sure that the contractor still makes profits at the end of the day, so he continue to sign the union contract so you can continue working. Right. So I think that that's a distinction maybe that's not made by the average proletarian out there.
No, it's all through the lens of ideology, to be clear. Yeah. I'm trying to get at the underlying dynamic. And one quick point is that, yes, it's an alliance between the workers and the capitalists, because the capitalists, not because they have the workers' best interests in mind, but because they have a common interest, and not the capitalist class as a whole, not financial capital and the state, but the capitalist individual capitalists that own capital, that own property, that is real property, they want that to come back. You know, so that's the idea anyway. It's obviously ideological, but sorry.
The other thing I wanted to say too, before I kick it to Varn, I swear I'm going to kick it to Varn, is because this just happened to me today at work, these two little incidents. The first is, I had a conversation with the operating engineer, and his main reason, like, as a proletarian to vote for Trump is the no tax on overtime shit. He is like, I'm going to start accepting overtime out the ass. I'm going to take 16-hour days. Exactly. If Trump's not going to tax it, I'm going to do great. I said, you really think they're going to do that? He's like, yeah, he promised it. I was like, okay, all right. I said, I did say to him, but bro, you realize that, like, if they get us working more overtime, that means there'll be, like, less people employed and we'll just be overworked all the time. He's like, well, we'll manage it when it comes. Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's the hustling. You're hustling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're hustling. But the very business union mentality. But then the other thing that happened, and this ties into Trump's trying to draw in proletarian workers, is my shop steward's from Pennsylvania. And so he's like on the different Facebook message groups, and he was talking with a bunch of people. He's back in town after the election. And he's like, everybody I know who does drilling, who did any fracking at any point in time, is like getting all of their rigs serviced up. They're getting all their certifications back. They're getting all their welding equipment ready to fucking go back to work. It's going to be boom times, they think. I don't know if this is true, in Pennsylvania. And so this material draw of Trumpism for, like, a Spanish worker, for an English speaking worker, is like a very real thing when you're not looking at it in terms of class, when you're not looking at it in terms of political economy, you're just looking at it from, like, your own pocketbook.
Self-interest,
and he's been very effective in that. So I wanted to bring up those real world examples from work today. Varn, what do you think about this question, the racial depolarization and the man question?
So there's a lot there, and I'm going to break it down into some components. And in doing so, I'm actually going to get to another point that I am going to agree with Reed, but extend it. Reed talked about the Democrats as the party of the petite bourgeois and the Republicans as the party of capital, but then admitting that like a lot of the actual capital accumulating petite bourgeois are actually land the Republicans. Think about all the people in the chambers of commerce, right? I want you, however, to look at the longer-term racial employment stats tied to that, because then it will make some of these things that we blame on Cubans and Puerto Ricans and machismo, which I think all that's real, by the way, particularly with Cubans and the machista. But I do think we have to look at a few trends that probably exacerbate this. So first, let's state what we know right now. Very quickly on the racial stats, there was a pretty large drop in Black men supporting the Democratic Party. However, that large drop was still a majority. So majority still 70% roughly still support Democratic Party. Now, I want to point that that's actually a historical norm going post the Civil Rights Act. So after the Civil Rights Act, about 70% of Black men supported the Democratic Party. That changed with Obama to something like 90%, 95%, somewhere in there. I can't remember. But it was huge. And Democrats just assumed that was going to be forever. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of reasons tying this back into what Reed was saying about which parts of capital these parties tend to favor. All right. So Democrats, I think, favor rent-seeking and financial enterprises as a whole for a variety of reasons. One of which is these tend to have monopsony pricing powers and can absorb regulations. Another is a lot of them have dependencies on the state, either in forms of state contract or in state direct employment, which makes them less hostile to taxation. They have mixed relations on whether or not they're productive or unproductive in the general economy.
Thinking of lawyers when you say this. Lawyers is a huge part of the Democratic
race. Right. Lawyers, exactly. School administrators, middle management. You know, I always talk about this. I'm with Reed. I think the PMC thesis confuses things. Like, I don't even know what it is as a class. But as a way to get to, like, some vague social reality, it's kind of true. In the sense that there's a bunch of rent-seeking industries tied into the Democratic Party. Because those rent-seeking industries had to comply with federal demands, they were also often, particularly in the municipal sector, good employers of Black labor. All right? Which tied them in to Democratic projects.
The machine. In addition,
yeah.
Patronage machine.
It's a patronage machine. In addition, when the Dixiecrats died in the South, and that happened way later than people realize, it's about 2000, those machines, those old Dixiecrat machines, were pretty much just handed over to the Black Congressional Caucus. There is, however, a pretty long-standing and well-documented difference in educational outcomes between Black women and Black men. And one of the things we have seen is the Democrats have pretty much put their entire stock and trade on what is a weirdly declining demographic. It hit its peak actually in 2021, which is college educated people. So by focusing on that almost exclusively, and you look at the way this policy has been tied in, you do have a bunch of Black men who feel alienated by this. Let's go and look at the Latin case. Now, I think there is a truth that there's a lot of, like, when we talk about Latin, we talk about Latin and Hispanic people as if they're a unified group, racially, culturally, etc. And that's kind of funny because I spent a lot of time in Latin America and that's just not true.
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in Queens, Brooklyn, and the Bronx too.
Right. But I do want to say that, like, in addition to the machista stuff, because of language barrier issues and early immigrant issues, a lot of Latin businesses are petite bourgeois businesses that accumulate capital. They were hurt by the pandemic. pretty strongly. And they get hurt by taxes. High tax rates actually hurt them. It is not just an illusion. They don't have high profit rates, so they can't absorb the tax regime as easily. I think that does a lot to explain what is going on in those communities. In addition to things like Cuban and Venezuelan immigrants and stuff like that,
Also
plays cultural norms play in. But I don't think we can separate all this out. Now, when it comes to the man question, I have to think back to a book that we've all forgotten from way back in the 20-teens, early 20-teens, by a liberal commentator whose name I can't even remember. But that is the End of Men book from like 2011, 2012, somewhere in there.
I remember the name.
And that was because the 2007 to 2009 recession hit construction and other male-dominated fields harder than it hit. Hannah Rosen hit care fields. Long Duray today. When I was talking about the like wage earning working class in 2018, it was about 50-50 men and women. When I talk about it now, it's more men. Now, why is that? There's a bunch of reasons.
Talking about wage or salary?
No, I'm just talking about in general.
In general.
There are more men in the employment sector for a variety of reasons. Health, child care is one of them. Disability is another. But the other thing is there's a lot more women who are educated. I can tell you, I teach classes to students out here in Utah that prepare first-generation college students to go to college. I have not had more than one man in that class in 3 years.
I have the same experience. And I think I saw a lot of data on this too. I mean, there's been a significant decline in, men going to college. So I think kind of the gender gap in higher ed is pretty real. Somebody on Twitter, everybody at this point is like putting, there's like the blame game going on, like who caused this? What's wrong with you? And I think one of it was like, oh, white men who are not going to college, why you keep voting for Trump, even though his support among them declined a little bit, somebody had posted on Twitter, and then a leftist clapback was, well, maybe if we have free education, we wouldn't have this problem,
They're all going to Andrew Tate University.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is real. And I think that's also part of this kind of like anti-establishment, anti like woke left liberalism stuff that a lot of young men are gravitating to. Right. But I think that has to do a lot with the nature of work. Right. Has completely shifted. Yeah. Also, so technology, like a lot of tech jobs, like you don't need a college degree. College is so damn expensive, but I do think like kind of the gender gap in higher ed. We saw the gender gap even in like in the voting patterns, right? Even among Gen Z, I think the gender gap among Gen Z is actually really interestingly like pronounced, but yeah.
Enough that a lot of commentators are like, Gen Z are the new Hitlerites. Gen Z men anyways. I think this is a good moment for us to transition to the paywalled portion, Andy. What do you think?
Yeah, so we did a great job looking at the kind of economic foundations of this election and the shifts that we saw. The next section, I'd like to talk about what the next 4 years might look like. Yeah. And then I'm going to get out an old box with a full of, it's from 2017, it's full of safety pins and pussy hats. I'm going to pass them around because we're doing the resistance again.
And it's weird that it's like retro almost, that Trump's president again.
You might want to wash it. They're a little moth-eaten.
Sure.
All right, so we'll talk about what the resistance might or might not look like when we come back.
We'll see you guys on the other side. www.patreon.com/theantifada. Become a supporter of our show. Check out that bonus content and so much more. We'll see you on the other side. America, America, if you
donut.